$4 billion plus has been spent on DEI in the US with zero proven ROI. From what I've learned about evolutionary psychology, it's kind of obvious because
Tim Ash has helped create over $1.2 billion in value for companies like Google, Expedia, Nestle. He's also the best-selling author of multiple books, including his latest, Unleash Your Primal Brain. He's delivered hundreds of keynotes across four different continents to share his insights about psychology and persuasion.
One single tribe doesn't carry the whole cultural package anymore. People are overlapping belonging to a bunch of tribes in a modern society. And the whole thing with polarization of work, what you want to do is you want to kind of get your work group so tight that all of those other tribes, all those default tribes that people are bringing to work are going to get activated less. And your work cultural tribe is going to get activated more. So here are the five strategies to bond any group, the positive polarization toolkit. Number one.
The key to life, it isn't money. It's happiness. And when you measure how happy you are, you actually become even more happy. Our friends at GoBundance, the tribe of millionaires, use a very specific tool to measure their happiness. It's called the Life Happiness Index. And you can have it too. Go over to GoBundance.com/LHI and take your Life Happiness Index assessment. You'll rate yourself in multiple categories on exactly how happy you are and get a custom output for you specifically that you can use in developing whatever goals you have for your life. GoBundance is the tribe of healthy, wealthy, generous people who choose to live epic lives. And the tool GoBundance members use at the base of all of that is the Life Happiness Index. Get out there and grab life big. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Tribe of Millionaires podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Gruber, and we've got a cool guest today. I was introduced to him by a friend, Adam Hill. Tim Ash has helped create over $1.2 billion in value for companies like Google, Expedia, Nestle. Probably heard of a few of them. You probably also have heard of where he's been cited, which is Forbes Entrepreneur Magazine, as a top online marketer. He's also the best-selling author of multiple books, including his latest, Unleash Your Primal Brain. He's delivered hundreds of keynotes across four different continents to share his insights about psychology and persuasion. And he might be the best self-taught salsa dancer that you are likely to meet today. Tim Ash, welcome, my friend.
Thanks, Jamie. It's a blast to be with you.
When and where was this a COVID thing to teach yourself salsa?
No. It was just like white boy goes to salsa clubs in San Diego and figures it out the hard way. You know, just a lot of hard work and a lot of very patient partners. The good thing is in Latin dancing, the guy asked the women. So they usually will say yes to just dancing with you. So I always ask the good people, and that's how I learned to dance.
My wife is Dominican. So she was born and raised in the Dominican Republic. And I, whiter than you, taught her how to salsa dance. Can you believe it? Thank you to my high school dance teacher. She showed me how to, she wasn't even my dance teacher. She did something, taught salsa once, and it stuck. So there we go. I want to talk about let's start with defining something first. You are an expert and an authority, really, in evolutionary psychology. Can you just, for the sake of me, the audience, let's start with, can you define the term? What is evolutionary psychology?
Yeah, so you're using those $2 words there, partner. Yeah, evolutionary psychology, I think, is basically the basis of all psychology. And the premise is that in order to understand how we behave and why we do the things we do, you have to retrace the whole arc of evolution. In other words, some things like, say, dopamine and chasing rewards, well, we share that with fruit flies. I mean, that goes back several hundred million years. And then there are things we picked up along the way when we became mammals that we share with all herd animals. And then at the end of our evolutionary arc, there's some truly bizarre stuff that makes us human and unique and is the reason that we took over the whole planet, like storytelling, spreading culture, mentoring other people, polarization, our highly social natures. That's distinctly human. So if you want to understand psychology, you kind of have to hit the rewind button and understand the whole arc of evolution. So that's the premise of evolutionary psychology.
Tribe is a component of that. Of course, this podcast being called Tribe of Millionaires, it's implicit in saying, hey, you want to find the people that you align with, that you're like-minded with, or not even that you want to, but that's what we do as human beings. But part of that today, we're so tribal that we're polarized, and even not just politically, but even in the workplace. So what is it about How are we polarized in the workplace, and how can that be leveraged? How can that be taken advantage of if you're a business leader?
Wow. Well, let's dig at the roots of this a little bit, if we can. Obviously, polarization is a huge issue, like you say, on any scale, you know, around the world, nationally, in our workplaces, in our personal lives. So it's not just some kind of bug, it's a feature. And that's the thing to realize. Like, the approach that I've seen, I think a well-meaning approach, is, well, let's just get rid of polarization. Let's stamp it out. Let's all sing kumbaya and be one big universal tribe, right? But that's not what we evolved for. If you really want to kind of get a glimpse of the environment in which we became tribal and polarizing, go back 200,000 years to the plains of East Africa where modern humans evolved and think about what your typical day was like. Well, there was no typical day. You were part of a tribe with a few dozen people, about a third of them were probably distant relatives in one form or another. And if you were the men, primarily, you would go off and try to find food. And that meant that you didn't know what was going to happen that day. You had to follow orders. You had to coordinate very well and just basically do things when you're told if you're a subordinate. So there was kind of a hierarchical structure to that. And everything, all of your survival depended on this cultural package that the tribe carried. Your whole world depended on what you guys collectively knew and could transmit as a tribe. So the way to think about human evolution is it's really tribe on tribe competition. If you ran across other tribes, they had their own cultural package. And that cultural package was unknown to you. And if they were more effective, they're going to outbreed you, kill you, assimilate you, or convert you, or enslave you. I mean, there weren't a lot of good options. Which of those do you want, Jamie?
Yeah, none.
Yeah, none. Exactly. So that's the environment in which we evolved. I guess the best way to describe it is we have to be loyal team players first and foremost. That's more important than being right. So we're basically designed to prioritize group advantage over individual advantage. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. Because we're in this really weird Western culture where we think our individual happiness matters. That's not what we evolved for. We evolved to essentially parrot the beliefs of our tribe. Let me give you just a quick thought experiment. Let's say, you know, you were a sailor and you climbed up on the mast of a sailing ship and you saw that there was a slight curvature to the earth, right? And you go, you know, I don't think the earth is flat. I think it's a ball and we're curving around it. You know what we'd do to you? We'd throw you off that freaking mast, right? I mean, look, there's no time for people to go their own way. You have to just be a blind loyalist and get with the program. And if you don't, there's like these escalating sanctions against you. It will gossip about you, will badmouth you to your face, will deny you economic opportunities or mating opportunities, will throw you out of the tribe. That's actually pretty extreme, you know, like to just excommunicate you because people can't survive on their own. Or we could kill you, but throwing you out of a tribe is pretty much as bad as it gets because that means you'll die by yourself. So there's sanctions for not being a good team player, and we enforce this tribal loyalty within each tribe.
Why is that a feature? That's interesting. You said it's a feature, not a, I forget the
word.
Not
a bug, yeah.
Not a bug, right. But I'll be honest, as you talk through that and I filter it, and I don't know where I am evolutionary, maybe I'm way behind here, but but that all seems counter to, you know, the visionaries, the big thinkers, the things that the change agents, those that buck the trend and so on and so forth. So why is it a feature, polarization?
Well, again, even the way we talk about history, we tend to focus on these larger than life figures that were transformative in some way, but they had to buck some really strong forces to be that iconoclastic. That's not most people. We're here to get along the group norm, to do basically what other people tell us. There's this kind of trap door in our head from an evolutionary standpoint, that where we assimilate our cultural package. I mean, your brain gets wired up really early in life, before the age of 5, a lot of things happen. You're just drinking that in, and that's what helps you survive. I mean, think of it this way. Let me put it to you this way. If I, you know, people are everywhere on this planet, right? We're on the tops of mountains, in deserts, on remote islands in the middle of giant oceans, in jungles. It's like, why are we so successful? And we didn't adapt physically that much to that. like squirrels will adapt to hibernating in the desert or climbing trees with rotating ankles if they're, you know, tree squirrels. We just adapted our brains to download the cultural package for each environment. So if I stuck you in the Arctic right now, you're screwed. You'd just die in a few hours probably. But if you put an Inuit there, they're fine because they have their whole cultural package that they learned. If you put the Inuit in the Australian outback, they're screwed because they don't have the cultural package to survive in hot places with no water and seven of the 10 deadliest creatures on Earth. But the Australian Aborigine wouldn't survive in Times Square. I mean, you plop him there in a loincloth, he's going to probably get run over by a car or get shot for climbing over the wrong fence. You know, it's just, you need the cultural package to survive in your existing environment. That's how we adapted. We placed one big bet on learning the cultural package around us.
Are we in an era where, and I don't know how this plays in from an evolutionary standpoint, it's more of a maybe a technological standpoint, but are we in an era? You mentioned about if you ran across other tribes, then you might be indoctrinated or killed or whatever it might be.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we used to not run across other tribes. There was geographic independence. Now, I mean, everything is so interconnected in the world that we're in. So are we at a place where tribalism and polarization are enhanced? And is that a good or bad thing, I guess, because we are able to see what every tribe is doing and we can judge it, or we can listen to the thought leaders talk about it?
Well, okay. So yeah, let's talk about how this works in the modern world. Again, in the past, imagine your whole cultural package was carried by the few dozen people around you.
Which makes total sense.
You know, it's your religion. Oh, the thunder, the god of the sky is angry, or, you know, okay, I can chip pieces of flint off of a rock, and that's technology, and, you know, storytelling or dancing, that's our entertainment, gossip, that's our politics. I mean, the whole cultural package, all of the rituals, everything was carried by one tribe, right? But like you say, we no longer live in a single tribe. Back even 10,000 years ago at the start of the agrarian revolution, there are somewhere on the order of 1 million or 10 million humans on the planet.
Yeah.
Right. So you rarely ran into anybody else, and you'd want to mate with them for genetic, you know, diversity reasons, just because inbreeding too much is a problem as well. But other than that, there wasn't really that much contact. And now what happens is one single tribe doesn't carry the whole cultural package anymore. You kind of pick and choose. So I'm with you, a member of the aerodynamic haircut tribe, right? I'm in the Mercedes driving tribe, I had LASIK surgery tribe, or parent of multiple teenagers tribe currently. So some of those are chosen. Some tribes we don't choose, like nobody decides what kind of body they're going to get or where they're born or to join the orphan tribe voluntarily or to grow up in a war zone or suffer abuse of some kind as a child. I mean, nobody picks those tribes, and yet you're a part of those tribes as well. And there's a lot of voluntary tribes where we live, what we do for work, how we speak, how we dress, the brands that we're loyal to. Those are also very tribal. So people are kind of, think of them as an overlapping belonging to a bunch of tribes in a modern society. And so the question is, which tribe is going to get activated in a particular context? And the whole thing with polarization of work, what you want to do is you want to kind of get your work group so tight that all of those other tribes, all those default tribes that people are bringing to work, are going to get activated less, and your work cultural tribe is going to get activated more. Now, some it'll never override. Like, you're not going to come to work and say, I'm changing my religion just because it doesn't fit here, right? I mean, or I'm changing my race or my identity, you know, racially. That's not happening either. But still, there's a lot of like lower level things that can get superseded by having a really strong, bonded, intentional work tribe.
When I was in my corporate gig, I was an executive with Progressive Insurance for a number of years, 21 years total, I was there. And toward the end, this was 2.5-3 years ago at this point, toward the end, there was a big push on D&I initiatives. And it felt like, I love what you just said, a team, an organization, a department, whatever, you know, the leader of that department can create, you know, in a positive way, a culture that supersedes all other things, right? Mm-hmm. On mission, whatever it might be. Yeah. But then it felt like, you know, with good intention, the company is creating derisiveness, creating polarization, by divisiveness, divisive, whatever it is.
It could be derisive divisiveness. It could be both.
There you go. All my big words. With these subgroups and D&I councils and initiatives and employee resource groups that were along racial lines and sexual orientation lines and everything else. And it felt hard as a leader of a large organization to bring a group of people together because, yeah, okay, the idea is educate on what it is to be a Black woman or a gay man. I get that. But there's some people who have a religious conviction, like, let's say, that mm-hmm. says a gay man is not, they don't recognize that. I can't get down with that. So it would create like mini pockets within my tribe, if you will, my organization.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world do I overcome that if I'm the leader of a 5-person, 10-person?
Well, yeah, I can talk about what I call the primal brain company and how to do that. And we can also talk about how to build groups and tribes in any setting. I mean, I'll tell you the mechanisms. Those are pretty well understood, from an evolutionary psychology standpoint. But I want to say that, it's not, there was an opinion piece in the Times, in the New York Times, fake news, I know, 4 or 5 months ago. And it was basically $4 billion plus has been spent on DEI in the U.S. alone, and zero.
That's diversity and inclusion.
Equity, inclusion, DEI. That's one of those alphabet soup things. So $4 billion has been spent on that with zero proven ROI.
Right.
Okay. And then you have to question why. And for me, just again, from what I've learned about evolutionary psychology, it's kind of obvious because what you're trying to do is stamp out polarization. You're basically saying we have to be one big tribe. And when in the very depths of our DNA, we're screaming to belong to a tribe and to polarize against an opposite, it's going to be hard. So that's on one level. On another level is a practical thing. You can do that diversity, equity, inclusion stuff, if you have two preconditions. One is you have to have people that want to do it. Yeah, I want to bond tighter as a group and span differences and bridge differences. That's not your typical employee, I would say.
Right.
They don't necessarily want to. They don't want to even waste the time on it, but they might even be resistant to it, like you were saying, right? And the other thing is it can only work in smaller groups. So in other words, if my premise was, you know, Jamie, I want to understand you really well. Tell me about your background. Tell me about your Dominican wife. Tell me about, you know, your beliefs and traditions and cultural stuff, life events that shaped you. And then I'll do the same. Okay, now I'm a team leader. I got to do that with my other 7 direct reports. Well, shit, howdy. All of a sudden, I'm spending all my time understanding my people instead of doing anything productive. And at some point, very quickly, it just doesn't scale. Tribes can be formed around some very basic things. There are tens of millions of people in this country. If you say religion, guns, personal freedom, let's probably throw in mostly whiteness there. That can, those four sentences can bond tens of millions of people. You see how much more effective that is at kind of forming tribes, as opposed to saying, we're going to have a tribe where I respect your inherent worth as an individual and get to know everybody. I don't see how that's scalable, just as a practical matter.
Interesting. Is there any organization you know of that has bucked the trend on DEI?
Well, I think we're starting with the wrong premise. It's not bucking the trend. I think it's going against it's swimming against a rip current when you can be surfing the wave. Okay, so sure. if you understand polarization, you can use it to do good. You can use it to intentionally polarize workplaces in a healthy way. So the way you do that is first you have to do. So this is my primal brain company framework. The first thing you have to do is tribe spot. Tribe spotting is going into your workplace and recognizing all of those differences. It could be by where people sit in the lunchroom, or there isn't a lunchroom and it's a hybrid workforce, or it could be by age. It could be by background. It could be by what they do after work, right? And you'll be able to kind of see all of these overlapping tribes in action and understand which ones are the most activated, the ones that people feel the most loyalty to, right?
Yep.
So that's step one. The second is to explicitly define your cultural package. Now, this is the job of the leaders. You're the ones that are supposed to have the vision, the connection to purpose and source, whatever you want to call it, right? How big is your calling? They have to be the ones that say, this is what's important to us, because they also, I'll talk about this in a sec, have to live those values. So the leaders have to say, this is where we're marching. Follow me on this crusade. Okay. And that means defining not just, I'm sorry, some bullshit mission statement that you came up with in your PR committee that's, you know, in big letters behind your reception desk in the lobby. Okay. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the whole cultural package, just like in the original single tribe that we evolved for, language, social organization, rituals, technologies, belief systems, values, all of it. That's your cultural package. And you have to think of it that holistically and completely. And then also you have to have an outgroup. You have to say, okay, these are the things we stand for. What do we stand against? Like, we don't lie. We don't cheat. We don't, you know, whatever, you know, there's got to be some outgroup. We stand against something. Remember, polarization isn't optional, but you do get to define your cultural package and where the boundaries of your tribe are going to be very consciously, very completely as the leader or leadership team. And then the last step is you essentially have to create two sets of initiation processes. The first one's going to be to get recommitment from your existing employees, to, like I say, ladder them up so that they're more highly activated as a work tribe and it overrides some of their lower default tribes. And the second one would be for any new employees that you're bringing in, because you want them to be super properly positively polarized and actually to reject on the way in anybody who's not.
I'm assuming you design interview processes, questions, recruiting best practices around this culture package, correct? In order to...
So again, there's the three steps to a Primal Brain company is tribe spotting, creating the cultural package. And the last one is what I call the positive polarization toolkit. And if you want, I can go through that with you. Now, these are mechanisms by which you can bond any group.
I'd love to hear. I want to go back to tri-spotting in a bit, but I'd love to hear the mechanism by which you can bond any group. That's very interesting.
And then again, this goes back to our, you know, join me in my ancient tribe back in East Africa a couple hundred thousand years ago. Think about us as a hunting party. And this isn't just applied to men. I mean, the women had pretty uncertain lives, but they usually weren't going out and hunting. But so here are the five strategies to bond any group, the positive polarization toolkit. Number one, create uncertainty. Because we know there are rules to the game. We know there are social rules. But if it's in an uncertain environment, like if you've ever been to another country, for example, you know there's different rules. You just don't know what they are. But all of a sudden, you're drinking in all this new information because you're just like, I want to figure it out. So creating uncertainty is actually really important.
Interesting. Okay.
The second would be peer pressure. Again, not exactly new news, right? We norm to the behavior of people around us. And it's been shown to be, you know, some sociological experiments, super strong. You have people come into a doctor's office and there's a bunch of plants there and they all behave in bizarre ways. And the new person sitting down in that doctor's office is going to take on those bizarre behaviors. You know, so you just come into a group you're in, you go, whoa, all these people are acting around me the same way. And ideally unanimous, you know, there's very few people, like you were saying, these exceptional individuals, the Gandhis, the Nelson Mandelas, that can withstand unanimous peer pressure against them, pay a very high price. That takes a lot of willpower and sacrifice. So the second one is peer pressure. And I'm not saying coerce anyone, but just by example. The third is really important, and that is synchronized group rituals. Now, you know, in a modern context, you'd say, like, you've been to a sports stadium and you've done the wave probably, right? Or sang along to favorite song at a rock concert, or done yoga or Tai Chi, and you're doing a synchronized group activity. And it turns out you don't even have to like the people doing it with you, but you'll feel a sense of belonging, closeness, and being bonded with them by participating in synchronized group activities. Mm. And then another important part of it is there's got to be a challenge in the initiation. It can't be given to you. Like a lot of companies are like, oh, here's your branded coffee mug and t-shirt with our logo on it. And everybody will post that on social media when they join day one. But like, how much tribal loyalty did that buy you? Not very much. Unless you go through the fire with me, unless you run the gauntlet on whatever metaphor you want to use, I don't value it. But if it's hard, if you go to Google and you get gangbanged in a dozen interviews and they're hard on you, and then they make you take a coding test, and then you meet the team members and they have to like you. After that, you're like, yeah, I made it into the Google tribe. I mean, it's not easy. So a challenging, effortful initiation is really important. Like, and I'm not saying, damage people or,
Oh, you said gangbang. You did say gangbang at Google.
I did. Sorry. I'm going to politically incorrect. I'm sorry.
I just thought that was an interesting Google initiation practice. I didn't know that existed. So
well, it depends on which department you're in, I guess.
But I think of fraternities with rush week, right? Like,
right. These are kind of negative examples, right? So, yeah. But fraternities are never going to get stamped out. They have such loyalty from the hazings, from the extreme challenge of the initiation, that you're going to be loyal to them. The same with gang jump ins. You might be asked to kill someone to be in part of a violent gang. That's your initiation.
Yeah, but this is for any group, like you said.
This is for any group. Yeah, yeah.
Bad, corporate, not corporate. Like, but that's
exactly
the,
any group.
That's the example.
Right. So I don't care if you're starting a stamp club or a doomsday cult. This stuff works. Okay. Yeah. And then the final one, and this is really important, I think, for your audience and for me personally. My latest speech on polarization is aimed at executives, senior executives, the impeccable example of the leaders. I talked about peer pressure earlier, but we're not peers as leaders. People look to us disproportionately as a source of example. So if you're like, we're a people-driven organization. By the way, what were those quarterly financial numbers? I mean, people can see your bullshit, right? You have to impeccably live the values and model the behavior, because people are going to go off of that. Leaders carry disproportionate weight, by the way, which is why the leaders have to define the cultural package. It's their show. You want to be in this tribe? This is my vision. This is where we're going. You're on board or you're not. That's fine. Either one's fine, but this is where we're going. That's the function of a leader. It's not to micromanage people. It's to set the vision, direction, and cultural package. Here's the five, again, just to recap: create uncertainty.
Yep.
Peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Synchronize group activities. A challenging and effortful initiation, and the impeccable example or modeling by the leaders. And again, like you say, this is whether you're starting a religion or a Facebook group, they work the same way. I ran this by another fellow keynote speaker. He's a decorated Navy SEAL, a guy named Jimmy May. He lives here in San Diego too. And he's like, dude, you just described SEAL selection training.
Yeah.
Buds, it's like 85% washout rate by elite soldiers. Well, it's because that's probably the most extreme, but also closest setting to that hunting party I was talking about. Your life literally depends on the people around you and you guys being closely bonded. And that's what it takes: uncertainty, peer pressure, synchronized group activities, challenging initiation, and the impeccable behavior of the leaders.
These all make sense, and I can think of examples for each of them across different spectrums. You talked about like SEAL training. Once a SEAL, always a SEAL, right? Fraternities, we talked about. Even just being an alumni from a college creates.
Yeah.
People are always a Sooner or a Crimson Tide or whatever the hell they are.
But right. Or in high school, you were a nerd or a drama geek or a jock or a soch or whatever, right? I mean, those are the same things it took to get into those social circles back in high school.
Can you, though, give me an example? What I'm struggling with is the very first one: create uncertainty. Can you make that tactile for me?
Yeah. By the way, I'm not saying you should just have chaos reign in your companies. That's not the point.
Yeah.
The positive polarization toolkit is only in the context of an initiation experience. So you'll, like, again, to recap that, you'll need one to retrofit this to your existing employees and get the bad apples out. Mm-hmm. So everyone's on board. And the second one would be for onboarding new employees. Okay. And so in when I say uncertainty, like if you say, well, we're going to have this team offsite and we're going to, you know, here's the agenda. Here, I'm going to tell you exactly what we're going to do. And the first thing we're going to do is get to know you round table. And then we're going to have a ropes course and then we'll have a nice lunch with some vino and, you know, and then you have some free time on your own in the afternoon. Okay. And the purpose of that is this and this and this and this. You feel really comfortable, right? Mm. What if I just said, hey, Jamie, we're gonna do something on Friday. You get the full day. It's paid. You know, just wear comfortable clothes and shoes with good traction.
Hmm. So I'm the leader. I've got certainty in what I'm going to deliver that day, but I'm leaving it open for you, or I'm demanding in some ways, I guess, that you
be comfortable with discomfort and not knowing what's going to happen. Because that trust it requires faith, and that is bonds you as a team, and you become more receptive to like, whoa, what's important here? I don't know what's important. I just was told to bring shoes with good traction, right?
Connect these for me. Maybe you have, and I just need it like nailed into my head. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, in order for step one to be creating uncertainty or the first element of bonding.
That's not the first step. I'm just saying all five of these should be used as a cocktail to be most effective.
That's what I needed to know. So these are not an in order thing. These are five elements that need to be in place.
Five elements of an effective initiation into a tribe where you're going to intentionally polarize.
In advance of something where you're launching this. So going back to defining your cultural package and tribe spotting. So at what point do these elements where you're going to create or bond a group, let's say in a corporate or a business setting in your business, mm-hmm. where along the lines of tribe spotting, defining your package and creating initiation processes, does this fit? Is it throughout? I'm trying to sort of tactically line all of this up.
And so I think that unless you're doing a brand new startup and you haven't even hired employee number two yet, you're going to have existing employees. So that's the premise. So what you're going to do is that positive polarization toolkit to kind of up-level the polarization in your tribe intentionally has to be done on the current employees. Yeah. And it takes a variety of forums. For example, I was just speaking to an executive group yesterday, in fact, and one of the guys used the EOS. You've probably heard of it, the Entrepreneurial Operating System.
I just had Gino Wickman on 2 days ago. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So, and he was saying, we kind of did this cultural assessment. What do we stand for? And it became super clear as part of that process that one of our senior guys wasn't on board. And by the end of that process, he had left the company. Yeah. Just clarifying what the cultural package was got an existing employee out because they were not a cultural fit. And so you retroactively design this for your existing employees. And then every new employee that comes on board, there you have this extra advantage. They don't know what they expect at all. And there's unanimous behavior by everybody else who's already on the inside of the tribe, so that it's much harder for them to resist it if they're inclined to resist it, or it's much more compelling for them to get initiated by everybody that's acting the same way. That is that unanimous peer pressure I was talking about. So it's two separate activities. The first one, so first you tribe spot, that's an assessment where you decide, you know, you take a reality check about all the different tribes getting activated in your environment. Second, then again, this is the providence of the executive team. You come up with the cultural package.
Yeah.
It's not just by default. It's not just the personality of the leader. It's very, very deliberate. And once you guys are clear as a management team, then you create the positive polarization toolkit experiences for the two initiations. One, to upgrade your current employees and self-select some out. And the second one for onboarding new employees.
Makes sense. Can you go back? I wanted to ask about tribe spotting a little bit, just mm-hmm. again, making this really practical. And you gave some examples, right? Like, you know, these people are around the lunch table or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Can you give to a leader who might be listening and thinking like tribe spotting? Okay. What do I do? Like, let's say we're in an office. I've got, you know, whatever, 80 employees, 60 mm-hmm. employees, 20 employees, or we're virtual or whatever. Like, can you give some advice on, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm putting myself into my corporate, like, okay, what do I define as a tribe? How do I know what I'm spotting as a tribe versus just, I don't know, an interaction or whatever it is. Can you get a little granular on that?
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, let's talk about, since you're talking about granularity, about the scale on which I talk about polarization. There's kind of three levels of it. So the first is within the executive team. If you're not aligned there, I mean, it's very common. You have all kinds of power stuff. The closer to the top you are, the more power dynamics there are. So there could be polarization just within your executive team. More typically, it's across departments. Product says sales is full of crap and they think marketing is full of it and fulfillment and customer service. You know the drill. So everybody thinks that they run the show and they're the best contributor and everybody else is dead weight. Okay, that's pretty typical in a lot of companies. And then finally, it could be that the company is pretty aligned, but they're not aligned with their clients or their target audience. Let me give you an example. I guess you'd say I have a pretty inclusive world vision. Okay. So, and I think we can all agree, for example, that chicken sandwiches are pretty yummy. I mean, unless you're a vegan. So you like chicken sandwiches, Jamie?
Love them. Chick-fil-A. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will never walk into a Chick-fil-A because I know the cultural package that that company stands for. I can get chicken sandwiches other places. I have consciously made a decision never to walk into a Chick-fil-A.
Got it.
And by the way, they're super strong about their cultural package by their founders and, you know, their values. And there are a lot of people that attracts. So I'm not saying it's a negative. I'm mm-hmm. saying you have to take sides. You have to stand for something. Like a lot of corporate leaders think they can just duck this stuff. It's like, oh, I did my perfunctory diversity, equity, inclusion training, and now we're all good. Or, you know, we've been sanitized.
Oh man, that happens a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. It happens quite a bit. And then, you know, there's the lefty version of that, which is like, if you go to REI versus Bass Pro Shops, right? Both of them care about the planet and the environment at some level, but some are, you know, you can pretty much tell are lefties and others are not, you know, they're more the hunting, fishing, survivalist types rather than enjoy the outdoors and try to save the planet types, right? Again, these are gross simplifications, but you get the point. Each of those brands as a company stands for something. And as a consumer, as I self-select in or out as the target audience, do I feel at home with that tribe? So polarization happens at the executive board level, across departments, or even, again, between the company and its intended clients.
Why? How we just described that. So look, I'd go to Chick-fil-A. Actually, when I was in Florida, I went there and I had Krispy Kreme. Krispy Kreme donut. I haven't had those down here, so they were really good. I had three of them.
We have a In-N-Out Burger. That's the religion around here.
In-N-Out Burger. Yep, sure. I had three Krispy Kreme donuts in one sitting. Not proud of that, but I couldn't choose between the three different flavors. But anyway, my point is, like, you and I could have that discussion. We just did. Yeah, I love Chick-fil-A. And you're like, yeah, look, not for me. Not the spot I want to go. Not because of the food, but, like, you know, obviously you're saying that's not my tribe. That's not my, that's not where I want to go. So that's a polarized thing and that's fine. But what is it about human psychology, the brain, whatever, in this era where, man, like if I say I eat a Chick-fil-A and somebody has a religious or whatever, a concern about what Chick-fil-A represents. And I had this happen at the company I worked for, where a supervisor in my organization, I'm 2-3 steps down from where I was. It was literally about Chick-fil-A. I'm like, oh, let's do Chick-fil-A for lunch. And she like was offended heavily. What is it about this era in our psychology, whatever, that makes polarization that, like, Chick-fil-A can't exist for who it serves? Chick-fil-A needs to be broken and torn down because it's an evil institution, as an example, to many people. What is it about that in this environment? Why is it not? Because I think what I'm thinking right now is most companies should be polarized. They should represent who they serve, what they're about. That's it's niching in some ways, right? It's niching down to your target audience.
You have to stand for something. I mean, a brand is like jam on bread. You know, if you spread it too thin, you can't even taste it at some point. So you can't be everything to everyone. I mean, yes, there's the Sony's and the Cokes and the McDonald's, but those are like brands that have been around for decades and spent hundreds of millions of dollars on branding themselves, and they've assumed that kind of ubiquitous status. And I'm sure though they're struggling because the changing workforce and again, inside outside kind of stuff.
Let's look at Bud Light. That's an example of a McDonald's-esque before, say, April 2023, a McDonald's-esque brand, right? Like it's Bud Light, it's beer. Yeah. You drink beer or whatever, but not anymore. You know, one can with one influencer that represents a certain thing. And I personally believe that the bigger issue was the marketing executive who came out and pretty much called their base a bunch of frat boys that they don't want anymore. I think that was the bigger issue than the can, my opinion. Yeah. But holy shit. The firestorm. Yeah. Like it wasn't like, all right, well, Bud Light.
And by the way, I don't want to get into the, like the, I'm sorry, but the, to get into the wider culture wars, I'm not sure I have a solution for this stuff at a societal scale. One thing I will say that overlays and might be a useful contribution is there's a book that was written by a couple of historians in the late 90s called The Fourth Turning. I don't know if you're familiar with it. No. And they basically said that they're the ones, by the way, that came up with the notion of generations. So like boomers, Xers, millennials, Zs, that's all on them. They came up with that idea. And they basically said that history proceeds in these 80 to 100 year cultural cycles. And that's because that's the length of a long human life. And we only think of things in living memory terms. In other words, a civil war might as well be the Roman Empire. I mean, nobody was alive now during the Civil War. And so these cycles kind of inevitably repeat themselves based on the four generations that are kind of born into every one of these cycles. And so you inevitably go from a crisis to a post-crisis high to a cultural awakening to an unraveling, and that inevitably leads to another crisis. And I pretty much buy their I'm buying what they're selling, and they make a very compelling case for this going back to like 1500s England and all the way through U.S. history. And so, according to them, shortly after 2000 was the beginning of the current crisis period. So, if crap doesn't seem to work right now, if we all seem to be polarized, it's true. It's because nothing's working. And we're in the middle of one of these crisis periods, which will resolve by early the next decade. I mean, I know about you. I think you're a Gen Xer like me.
I am.
You know, it's like we grew up and things were more or less reasonable. Then they got worse and they keep getting worse. And that's just because of when we're born into this particular historical cycle.
Yeah. Well, okay. That answers it. I was asking from a standpoint of evolutionary psychology. And with polarization being a feature and it can be leveraged, and you've given some great examples of how, like, you know, some tactical steps and or elements that make up how polarization is a feature. But like, what is it about it today that polarization is such a bad thing? But you're saying it's more societal, not evolutionary.
Yeah, part of it is societal. I mean, there are really strong amplifiers, and it's the speed with things with which things are moving. There was a visionary futurist and his wife, Alvin Toffler, back in the 70s, he wrote a book called Future Shock. And he was talking about how the pace of change is speeding up. Yeah. You know, and so like if you're driving down the road or any car video game, you're doing fine. You're not bumping into stuff. Okay. Now try doing that at 100 miles an hour with the headlights off. Okay. Mm-hmm. Even the same tiny little movements are going to get you in trouble. So part of it is the speed with which things are happening, the speed with which information is transmitted through social media and so on. So there are every time you roll out a new technology, there's like probably a 20, 30 year adjustment period before we figure it out. And that's true of the printing press, of radio, of the Morse code and the telegraph. And it's certainly true of cable TV and now the internet. So we're just in a really messy figure it out period right now. And then on top of that, now we got AI, you know, and it's like,
I'm going to ask you about that at some point if we had time. So yeah, actually let's touch on it quick. You really were working on AI before AI was AI, right? You were doing this in college.
I was doing it in grad school at UC San Diego, very interdisciplinary, fantastic program. And I was working in the early days of neural networks, or what's now called machine learning and AI. We're working primarily on the algorithm side. How to have self-learning systems that figure things out by example, but we didn't have the big data sets available to train on. And so the reason it all kind of is peaking now is because with the internet, we don't have any problems getting large data sets. So you have all the data you want day long. And so it's now really taking off.
How does AI, as a leader who's listening to this and saying, man, this mechanism for bonding any group, you know, tribe spotting and defining your package, creating the initiation processes for existing and then incoming employees, when you're hearing these notions. Like, I know I'm putting myself in my own organization, like, wow, I got some things to really think about, some things to implement. Mm-hmm. Then you got this technological advancement that seems to be extremely disruptive. Again, news cycle would tell you, listen to certain people, like, this is the end of humanity and so on. How, if at all, does AI play into a leader's ability to execute on this from an evolutionary psychology standpoint?
Well, you know, first I'm going to inject a little bit of my personal viewpoint. I think I have a pretty positive constitution, like in terms of where my emotional balance or base point is. And as I get older, and I'm just like, what kind of world am I leaving for my kids? And I'm just like figuring out it's going to be the climate crisis, nuclear war, or the AI singularity. You know, it's got to be a fourth horseman if you're going to have a true apocalypse. I haven't figured out that one yet, but yeah, I don't know which one's going to get to the finish line first, but it's not looking good for humanity. I think there's some rough sledding up ahead for us. There's this fellow keynote speaker, Mo Gadot. He used to run Google X, like all their moonshot stuff.
Scares the hell out of me. Yes.
Yeah.
He scares the hell out of me. Yeah, he's extremely inspiring, but he scares the hell out of me.
Yeah. So one of his books was Scary Smart, and it's about the rise of AI and the inevitability of it. And I think I largely jive with his perspective, which is while it's small and it's still learning, we have a chance to influence it like a small child. And, so the best thing we can do is act like ethical human beings and not pieces of shit, because if it learns our biases, our tribalism, our polarization, and starts acting out on that stuff, it's not going to treat us very well when it becomes omniscient. So I think we have a tiny little window to get our act in order, and we're not moving in that direction at all, unfortunately. So I don't know. I'm not an optimist on how this goes down.
But is AI potentially something somebody needs to consider when they're talking about defining their cultural package? Is that potentially
a part? No, I wouldn't say that. So I remember when I was at UC San Diego, we had this, one of my professors was talking about different levels of understanding a system. He's like, we're talking about the brain and cognition. And he said, well, you can understand at the physics level, at the chemistry level, at the biology level, at the kind of structural parts of the brain, or you can talk about consciousness and awareness and higher order things. But you can only basically go between a couple of levels and understand their interactions. So he said, like, for example, you can take a water crystal, an ice crystal, and examine them. And each one truly is unique, the way they grow and the environment they're in. Examine them all day long, as many as you want. You will never predict an avalanche because that's an emergent property of millions of ice crystals. So some of these complex system things can't be predicted. I don't think it's going to be some, you know, Terminator, Rise of the Machines, they go hunting us, you know, with aerial drones, although don't rule that one out. But I think it's much more likely to be, Alexa, turn on my vacuum cleaner, open my garage door, and turn on my coffee maker. And all of those things have simplistic, stupid little programs that are interacting in super unexpected ways, each trying to optimize something simple. But what you get with the Internet of Things is some system-wide emergent behavior. It says, I'm going to get inefficiency out of the system. And guess what human beings look like to most algorithms? Inefficiency. So I don't think it's going to be deliberate. I think it's just going to be like, it's going to try to close the garage door on our neck repeatedly or something just to get us to stop trying to open the door. I don't know. You get the point, though. It's not deliberate. It's going to be accidental demise if it happens.
That's so interesting. Wow. Okay. All right. What else we need to know, if anything, on that note? What else we need to know, if anything?
We've covered, how humans got here and how we're about to check out.
Go out. Yeah, yes. That's the true end of evolutionary psychology. But
is there anything? Actually, it's true, because if we have embedded sensors in our heads and kind of a hive mind idea or generalized intelligence across people, you know, this, there's a guy, Harari, Yuval Harari, wrote a couple of amazing books. One of them, Sapiens, and the other one is Deus Ex Machina. And he talks about kind of the rise of superhumans. Evolution, this goes back to my what you asked earlier. How does this work in the modern world? Effectively, from an evolutionary standpoint, we're flies frozen in amber. Evolutionarily, we're not changing. I mean, we are. It actually is accelerating. But on the time scale that we have, sure, to act or have,
we're not different than 200 years ago, 500 years ago.
Yeah, we're not different than 50,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, not that different. So we're kind of stuck with the machinery we had for living in single tribes, and we're trying to adapt it to this 8 billion person civilization with tons of specialized overlapping tribes. And it's rough. I don't know. Again, I don't have any, most of my prescriptions are, you know, think global, act local types of things. Try to be a better person, regulate your own nervous system, get plenty of sleep so you're making good decisions, things like that. I cover in the book as well, personal prescriptions. But it's possible that essentially evolution ends and then artificial augmentation begins, and we might be last generation or two of humans born in the womb. You know,
wow, that's crazy. That is crazy. Well, we never know. We shall see. That's we can go down a whole rabbit hole on this. One thing on the evolutionary side of it, I heard recently, just interesting, was and it makes sense to me, is the concept of anxiety. Like you said, we're not much different than 50,000 years ago, and back then, anxiety was over after the anxious event occurred, meaning you're chased by the tiger, you're either dead, so anxiety over, or you got away and the anxiety's over, right? But now the tiger is constantly chasing us. We never stop being chased by the tiger. So our anxiety is not meant to be, but we are, you know, evolutionarily, from an evolution standpoint, or at least from our what we're built for, the anxiety is used to protect us from the tiger. The tiger never stops running, whether it's paying your bills or keeping up with the Joneses or whatever it might be. It's incredible. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. And this goes to leadership and entrepreneurship as well. But you're right. We had short-term events, like, you know, deal with it. And by the way, we have chemicals, like you've heard of runner's high and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, that's basically there to make you get away during violent encounters through the pain. It's like, oh, my arm's bleeding. Should I turn and get it up, or should I run from that bear? I think I'll run from the bear and then deal with the pain later. So we have endorphins that basically kick in to give us short-term pain neutralization, right? There's several kind of happy chemicals I talk about. But you're right, cortisol and stress chemicals, they don't just hit our bloodstream for a few seconds or minutes at a time. They have a half-life of hours or days. And in this slow drip of cortisol, it's almost like battery acid going into you. Like, can I make my mortgage payment? That's not stress we were designed to deal with. You're absolutely right. Like, do I have enough food to eat today? Yeah, that's a goal. That's a stress. Either do or I don't. I feel hungry, but I'll try again tomorrow. But not, can I pay this mortgage off over 30 years? So you're right. So one of the things we have to do is have really good self-care routines and stay out of that stress zone. And how this relates to leadership and entrepreneurs too, is we have about a 2.5 to 1 negativity bias because we have to pay attention to threats. So if I say, here's some ice cream, what's your favorite flavor?
Cookies and cream.
Cookies and cream. Okay. I got a bowl for it, Jamie, a bowl of cookies and cream for you. Now, as you reach for that bowl, I'm just going to whack you on the back of the hand one time with a hammer. Just the one time. Jeez. What do you say?
I don't want the cookies and cream.
Okay. So I know what's going to motivate you. It's the negative stuff. It's not the happy stuff, right?
Yeah.
By the way, which a lot of companies make this mistake in their marketing of just like, we're the world's greatest solution for, and instead they should be rubbing salt into the wound and talking about negative stuff because it motivates people and gets them off their comfortable spot. Okay, but back to this notion of negativity bias, entrepreneurs are often the screw you, I'm going to do it anyway types. And that's why they're successful, because what they're in effect doing is correcting for a 2-to-1 negativity bias by compensating by being extra positive. Yeah, I'm going to be successful. Yes, this is going to work. That's what it takes to actually have a more realistic view of stuff. Now that we don't have life or death consequences, we don't have to pay that much attention to the threats. In fact, we actually have to override them and ignore them twice as often to get more of a reality-based view of how things are unfolding.
But so that's a great point. And that's something that I've learned about myself, is that I'm more that, like, screw you, I'm going to do it anyway sort of thing, which is why I call it a late-stage entrepreneur. I only joined this world a few years ago. But on the same topic, though, or in the same vein, the negativity bias. So an entrepreneur says, screw you, I'm going to do it anyway. I don't succumb to, let's say, the negativity bias. But it should be leveraged then, no? Like you said, we're the company that's, this is the greatest, that we do this, we do that. Is it not more effective for that same entrepreneur who's bucking the trend, let's say, I know I used that term before, maybe it's the wrong term, to acknowledge the trend to those that they're looking to persuade?
Oh, well, no. So Let's switch gears a little. I can give you this as part
this
of
this is wide ranging, to, Tim. By the way, if you haven't figured this out, we're wide ranging conversation. So go for it.
Well, so let's talk about kind of persuasion, sales, marketing. That was my world when I ran a conversion rate optimization agency, one that helps make more effective websites for many years. So here's an example from an advertising. Let's say you had sold tooth whitening stuff, and you know, usually what you have is those commercials. You've seen them like have wonderful bling. You know, there's an actual bling on your teeth, you know, teeth kind of thing. It's like, you'll be so attractive and, you know, the opposite sex will fall all over you or whatever, right? That kind of stuff. But what if instead I sold this to you? So, Jamie, are you ashamed of those yellowish, dark gray teeth of yours? Does that make you close your mouth all the time and have resting bastard face? Are you not going to be successful on dates? You'll probably die alone in your little apartment, and the only way they'll find you is when the cat, after eating some of your body fresh, will start demanding healthier food.
Damn,
now you want some teeth whitening?
I want whitening paste. Yeah, Tim, I want it now.
Yeah, because you just rub salt into the wound. So I hear a lot of companies going, well, we're the nice brand. We don't say bad things. I mean, you don't have to badmouth your competitors, but if you don't badmouth my problem,
right?
If you don't make me see how bad it is, it's kind of like that workout motto you heard in the gym, right? No pain, no gain. It's true of marketing too. Unless you create a pain in me, there's no gain for you. The bigger the problem, the more I'm willing to pay to make it go away.
Dude, this is Planet Fitness. Like when we loop in everything we've talked about, the psychology of it, the sales persuasion, but it creates polarization. Mm-hmm. What we talked about, right? I think of Planet Fitness. Like Planet Fitness is the anti-lunk. Are you sick of that? Remember the commercials? Like, you know, this big beefy guy, and they'd like walk him out the back door. I pick things up and put them down. They serve pizza and donuts at the fucking gym. You know what I mean? Like, but that's the tribe they created, and they're polarized against the lunks. They've defined, like you said, they defined what they're not as well as what they are. And they've created that polarization, and they market to that. Are you sick of being body shamed at the gym? Are you sick of the lunk, you know, screaming and yelling and dropping the weights and all that stuff?
Yeah.
We got the gym for you. $10 a month. No judgment free zone, the whole nine, right?
Yeah. No, yeah. And no long-term commitments. Yeah. We got you covered, and have a nice piece of pizza pie while you're here.
No shit, man. I think I've heard 80% of subscriptions to Planet Fitness are not used. 80%.
Oh, well, that's just the model of fitness and gym. You sign up in January with your New Year's resolution. By February, there's nobody there. No, seriously, if they they have no capacity to actually operate a gym if everybody showed up.
No, but I mean, I cancel my $80 a month membership if I'm not using it. I don't cancel my $10.
So here in San Diego, I was part of 24-hour fitness.
Yes.
Okay? And they had this deal, like $6 a month. And for many years, I never went. And then I finally said, oh, this is stupid. I'm going to cancel it. And then by that point, it was like $50-$60 a month, and I never signed up again.
There you go. Right. So it's interesting.
Also, like recurring business models. Oh, you're going to charge me next month. Subscription models are the most powerful way to make money in the universe. Every successful company, Netflix, Verizon, whatever, they have this ability to take money out of your bank account every month without asking you, and you've forgotten it, and you've future discounted the value of that money. And subscription models are, again, from a business standpoint, take whatever you're doing and turn it into a subscription model. That's another piece of advice I can give you.
That makes sense. Does it have to be at a certain dollar amount, though? Do you have to be below a certain dollar amount?
Well, by chopping it up into smaller pieces, that also makes it more palatable, because we experience the same part of our brain experiences physical pain, emotional pain, and financial pain. They're all loss of resources or worsening of our situation. So as soon as you talk about large amounts of money, that's more painful. That's why you want to have free trials and not 1 cent trials. You don't even want to put a currency symbol in the ad.
That's interesting. Very interesting, man. This is incredible. I love this, the structures. I love the idea of polarization being a feature, and thank you for walking through and just letting my brain navigate some of this stuff. Cause we dipped it away from the psychological and into the cultural. We got got the AI wide ranging for sure. So let's get to this. Where is the best place for folks to learn more about you, what you're doing? Where do you want to lead people at this point?
Sure. The best place probably to go is primalbrain.com. That covers my book and my speaking. I keynote speak all over the world to executive groups and large marketing conferences. I have an evolved leader advisory for senior executives, unlimited access to me. Talk about any application from polarization to marketing of evolutionary psychology for your company, unlimited on call. So that's something to check out there. So primalbrain.com. If you're interested in the book, it's available in several translations, audiobook, ebook, paperback. Just go to wherever books are sold and look up Unleash Your Primal Brain.
So sold over 50,000 copies, if I'm not mistaken.
Right? That was my older books about online marketing and landing pages. Yeah, that landing page optimization. Yeah. That was also translated into, I think, 6 languages. Wow. Yeah.
Primal Brain is great. I love the book. I love all that you're doing. And I appreciate you bearing with me as we go through this big brain conversation with the little brain guy. So thank you for that.
Jamie, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.